Good morning. Well, that felt like a novella. I was like, and then what happened? Thank you so much. Yeah, and it feels like this is a family reunion, maybe for some of us. I mean, I presented many years ago, and this is actually my third time, and every time I tell, how are we doing? Like when we share pictures of our kids and we see this kid growing and what else are we doing? I'm glad that the previous speakers and the presenter touched on something, so I don't have to touch again on that. It is interesting. I was laughing and also thinking, reflecting when I saw the picture of Obama that was shown. And it reminded me that Alma Ata, the declaration of primary care of Alma Ata in 1978, said clearly that we needed to pay attention to politics with the big P and policies. Otherwise, whatever we do can be erased in a second. And that is a reality in this country and worldwide. If you fight alone, you take chances, you take a risk. When the community doesn't understand what's going on, anyone can come and erase what you did. When the community understands and is invested, then we are here for a fight. And we are going to defend that. And I think we did a lot for the Affordable Care Act, but we didn't do enough. And it's still time. We have time to do a lot. But it will require a different type of investment and leadership. And this is part of what I'm going to touch about, is we need the clinical skills, and we need to update them, and we need to sync them with whatever is happening and patient-centered approaches and all of that. But there are many other things that we need to learn and that we need to teach our workforce. We need to learn. It's not just teach, because to teach, you need to learn. And to learn, you need to unlearn. We learn too much and unlearn too little. So what happens when you learn and you don't unlearn is that you learn on top of what you learn, and then whatever, when things become hot, you go into your default. And usually the default is a learning that is not helpful. We need to learn new ways and dispose the other ones. So there are new ways. There are new ways where the community is there with you and we co-participate and co-train and co-lead. And that is a whole on learning in terms of our power and privilege and many other things. So I think that if we want to change things and change long-term, we need to invest in the long-term, not just in the technical part of the change. I want to start by sharing that slide, and that is another reflection. This is like my support group. So I'm going to think and share with you some things that are very dear to my heart. This is my dad, and this is America in Margarita Island in Venezuela. And that's a selfie, right? Or like my mom says, a selfish. So this is a selfie with one of my favorite men on earth. Dad is now here recovering. He was sick last year, and it was complicated, so I'm not going to touch on the details. But imagine America in the United States going to Venezuela every 2 months, not to get into the politics because that's another conference, taking medications to my dad because there are no medications in Venezuela. I had to go through all of that in 2011 with my mom with cancer, and the food is not there, and my dad retired with $2,000 a month after 40 years in the university, and is now making $4 a month. So it's just a disaster. So I'm here trying to deal with that, but the only person taking care of my dad is my mom. And she took care of him, and he's doing better. And I want to share that because I think that the personal is the professional. And also the personal is the political. And I won't pretend that I can be political or professional without being personal. In spite of the many teachings in the university that says that you shouldn't mix one with the other, what I learned is that that is not true. That was the biggest lie told to me in medical school, that you don't mix the personal with the professional. I think that without the personal, you are fragmented and you lose common sense. The personal is the one that guides me when I talk to moms in the community because I'm a mom. The personal guides me when I work with the Latino community because I'm a Latina. Latino Health Access is called Latino Health Access. It's not called Health Access. It's not called Global Health Access. It's not called Universal Health Access. It's called Latino Health Access. And we fought to defend that in spite of people saying you won't be able to fundraise because that only says Latino. Why don't you become something more general? Because you don't fight inequities being general. Because we need to focus on what matters, and if you have the inequity there, being too general produces what the doctor was talking here at the beginning, that even in Canada, you cannot reach the rural areas because they continue to be just brushed by the general. And that's why tuberculosis numbers decrease, but then you have this group with tuberculosis. And HIV numbers decrease, but you have this group with HIV that happen to be women of color and low-income women in low-income areas in pockets of misery around this country and around this world. So there is a way of fighting equity, and it has to be fighting the inequity with people affected by inequity at the center, with people affected by inequity as thinking people. I'm sharing with my friends and in my presentations what I learned from the Chief Investment Officer of one of the foundations in which I serve. And he always says that if you are not at the table, you might be part of the menu. Thinking in investments, right? So I think the same way. I think that if the community is not at the table, they are part of the menu. And our community needs to be at the table. And for that to happen, we need to open the table and be proactive and intentional in having the community at the table, with the people affected by inequity at the center. Otherwise, this is equity for who? And we end up doing equity to them. And that is not possible. So I thought about this because for me, health and wellness is very personal. It's personal because it's me, it's personal because it's my family and my community and Venezuela and the United States in many low-income neighborhoods, and because health is about dignity and health is about life, and health is not just about disease. And as much as we repeat this, at the end of the day, in our learning, no unlearning, when things get hot, we go into disease, and it's disease, and that's it. Because that's the only thing I do, that's the only thing is funded. What do you expect? I'm busy. And then we are trying to unlearn, and like our former president said, change has been slow. It's happening, though. And so, and probably among the groups that really get this is this group here. And we know that is slow. But now we are understanding that there are more things. And primary care always said that primary care is not just about disease. But at the end of the day, primary care became about primary doctors and diseases. So we need to also check on that. You know, primary care is not about primary care doctors. And primary care is not just about diseases. It has a strong component on prevention. And prevention has everything to do with place. And if the places are designed for inequities, that's what you're going to get. So we're going to have a lot of disease and very little prevention. And very little money invested in prevention because we are not doing the policy piece. So pharmaceuticals get to get big chunk of the money and prevention very little. Coca-Cola, a lot. Broccoli, little. So I'm not going to teach you about the things that you would be teaching me. I'm going to mention a few things in which you have been dealing with this, learning, going to workshops, We touched on the health spending earlier with our current president of the society, and we know what he said is what it is. A lot of money is being spent. The results are not the ones that we should have. The majority of the money is used for administration and pharmaceuticals. We also know what the Institute of Healthcare Improvement has been saying about the triple aim. We hear about this triple aim over and over, the importance of the patient, of the experience of the patient, of population health, and the importance of reducing cost. And we are working on that, right? You are working on that. And you are working with that, with this patient-centered approach that is trying to improve the patient experience. And I'm glad that people wrote this. I think that this is part of the fragmentation, because if I ask you, forget about patient-centered approach, forget that you are a doctor. Forget about all of that. Just be a patient for a second. And then think, if you are not fragmented, and I ask you, how would you like to be treated? Would you like for your doctor to honor your wishes? Would you like for your doctor to ask you questions? I mean, we don't need a training on patient-centered approach. We just need to connect. But sometimes in our role as providers, we disconnect. Then we need to be told what we already know. We already know this. It's a matter of bringing that personal person, that personal individual, that personal side to the interaction with others. Then we also are working on this to improve the experience, to decrease cost, the patient-centered medical homes. And in these homes, we are trying to coordinate, and then we are trying to design ways in which, if I pay attention to high-risk patients and I do a lot for them, I will save money. And if I understand the population and do predictive analytics, then maybe I can call this population health. And it is. It is a sort of population health, but it's not population health. Because population health happens in places. And the clinic is a place, so it is a sort of population base, but that population that you serve in the clinic lives in a place, works in a place. And if we don't pay attention to that, the surrounding, the life of that population that you serve will eat up your money. And there is so much you can do. It's like the whole thing that we are talking about tuberculosis. There is so much you can do about tuberculosis. If you don't want to focus on what really matters, still we are going to have it. And we are going to have it killing the poorest. So, and then we are talking about value-based. Value-based makes a proposition that allows us to think in these measures and measure a lot of other things that were not measured before. And yes, we are going to be accountable. But then I imagine, and I don't work in a clinic. I don't have to do this. As a matter of fact, I don't even work with Medical or Medicare. I never had. Hopefully, I never will. We already learned how to sell tamales and hot dogs. So hopefully, there is another way for us, for our organization. And I worry about the people that have to work like this. I partner with nonprofits that sometimes go 4, 5, 6 months without money, waiting for reimbursement, the ones that work with the government. But for the ones that have to work with all of these models, pretty much your time is there. There is so much time in creating the processes, the getting the reimbursement, creating, designing all of that, that is, it becomes very distracting from other things. If you expect to do this alone, or just surround yourself with people that know how to do this part. So the reality is that with all of those changes now in place for a few years, the disparities continue. Disparities in all populations, people of color, in comparison with non-Hispanic whites. And you can see that there are disparities among all groups in conditions that you know. You work with these populations, with Latinos, with Asian Pacific Islanders, with Native Americans, with African Americans, the disparities continue. And it's not just the disparities for all of them, but with emphasis in those groups in communities that are very impacted by inequities. So poverty continues to exist. It's like sometimes that's news for people. But poverty continues. There is extreme poverty in the US. And of course, when you compare with other countries, you might say, well, you know, it's not as bad as Haiti. But not a valid comparison, right? So a lot of poverty, now more people uninsured. We were doing great. Now we have 700,000 more people uninsured. The majority are US citizens. We are not talking about the undocumented uninsured. And with at least one person working in that family. So the health disparity, after talking for so many years and all the research in the world about health disparities, we know that health disparities are linked to economic disadvantage. That is not going to be overcome by healthcare strategies. So this is what has been called the social determinants, what surrounds people in that place. So the place where you live, where you play, where you work, where you learn, has everything to do with your health. And those are the social determinants. And that includes all of that, and it includes the immigration status, history. On top of that, we have a reality of primary healthcare workers shortage. Nationwide and in the state of California. So this is the estimate of the shortage, and you are teachers of family medicine. You know, you feel it. We also have less people choosing primary care as their specialty. The situation in California is that we have 7 million Californians, the majority of them Latino, African Americans, and Native Americans that live in the health professional shortage areas. Living costs rising, number of health workers continue to lag growing demands. Millions of Californians will find increasingly difficult to find care and afford care. So this is our shortage in California. And what is interesting about the conversation in California is that the answer that we are hearing and producing is not, let's recruit more people to join. But the answer we are hearing is, let's recruit the right people to be in the right place, doing the work in the right way. And it's a different answer. It's not the answer of just bring more people. Traditional answer, give me more money, the universities will say, we will find more people and we will produce more doctors. And then the doctors will go to places that might not be the places where we need them. So, what is being said now, and I will show you a little bit the report, is that we need doctors that can support communities where poverty is concentrated, where people of color live, that can speak different languages. There is a diversity of skills that are needed for this new workforce. 2 years ago, California assembled the first commission to explore this. And the commission name was California Future Health Workforce Commission. And I had the honor of being one of those commissioners. For 2 years, we worked with all the universities, health plans, hospitals, and community groups, and community working with community workers to put together this. 2 years. 2 years of an amazing experience in which I couldn't believe that we were saying the same but being so much in different pages. We were using the same words, like equity, but we meant different things. We all wanted to improve, but improve in different ways. So these 2 years allow us to talk and to reach some common ground in what became, and just was released, the final report on the recommendations on the California Future Health Workforce. And that is online. I'm going to share a few highlights of that report that makes this work different. One of the things that makes this conversation and this report different is that actually it talks about equity and diversity, and it shows that without that, we won't be able to reach what we want to reach. And it has a theory of change. The conversation about equity was present, but sometimes was ignored. And we went back to our learnings. Okay, let's talk about bringing more physicians, helping, opening more spaces in universities for residencies. But what that has to do with equity? So the equity conversation was brought back. And at the end of all of this conversation, we have recommendations where equity was present. Areas on the report are areas that you are going to connect with. The recruitment and support of students, just regular students, before they become medical students. Where are you going to do that recruitment? If you know that the rural areas are underserved, and you know that if you recruit people from rural areas and then they go back to rural areas to practice, probably they will stay in rural areas. If you know that, how are you going to do this recruitment? And how are you going to recruit students from rural areas that are behind in math already in third grade, where in fourth grade, they cannot read? How do you recruit? Do we recruit when they graduate from high school and they have good grades? How do we do this? So that is an example of conversation, and the recommendations in that area is to expand, scale that pipeline in different ways that can support those students that we need. Expand and support medical education. We are talking about the number of providers that need to increase to support financially those providers, to recruit then students from the rural area. Now that we help them, now let's recruit them and help them with their well-being, with the money, with so many things so they can graduate. And integrate the training on social determinants for primary care providers and for physicians. And this was a very interesting one that created a lot of discussion. What does it mean to include social determinants in the training of doctors? Because, you know, I was trained as a physician, and I saw something called like social health or epidemiology or social epidemiology. How do you learn social determinants? How do you learn inequity? We don't learn that having 1 hour class or a training in a semester. There has to be a way in which we experience this from day one throughout our careers. And the teachers cannot just be us. We need the community affected by the inequity teaching. So we also have to rethink, how do we do this in a way that produces a different type of experience that not only changes the data in your head, but your heart? Because now, that person in the community became your teacher. The person in the community becomes your coworker. And it's a different way of relating. And it's a different way that allows to appreciate. And then we talk about expanded role for primary care workers, including community health workers. Community health workers were in all the areas. We talk about three areas: primary care, behavioral health, and aging in place. So the community workers and peer navigators and peer workers were all over the map. And it was a key strategy and a key priority for the commission to expand and include community workers in all of those areas. Community workers have been included in many of your practice in clinics. For some clinics, already community workers are part of the team, but the scope of work is still limited. And then we talk about technology and how technology can be part of the solution, and then funding. And there were many ideas about how to fund this. This proposal already is in the hands of our governor, and we are advocating for the funding for all of this for 10 years. I want to go back to two areas, the social determinants and equity and the community workers, as two key components of what makes this different. So I'm going to, this slide you have seen many times probably, I'm going to explain it so you can see it throughout my eyes. When we talk about equity, this is what we are saying, Imagine that these apples here, that these are apples, and that these are your clinics and your wisdom and your advice available for everybody. But not everybody can receive it, because there are reasons why people cannot reach that. And these are the opportunities. And equity, we invest here so people can have the same opportunities. And here is that extra effort, that extra advocacy, those many hours of work. So I'm going to move to Orange County to share then how this way of thinking has informed our organization in many ways, including the advocacy at the state and national level. I want to share with you that in Orange County, poverty is concentrated, like in many other places, around this area. And this is Santa Ana, this is Anaheim. So this is what is called Central Orange County. That's also where the Latino community concentrates. This is obesity, the concentration of obesity in Orange County in the same place. And this is homelessness. The number of kids that are homeless in Orange County has increased dramatically. And if you go and visit these homes, you are going to see it. Many of you have been in those houses, have been in those neighborhoods, or come from those families and neighborhoods. So in Orange County, if you want to rent a one-bedroom apartment, you need to work 110 hours per week. If you make minimum salary, 110 hours per week leaves you with how many hours to take care of family and kids? How many? And I want now you to think again in a very defragmented way. If this were you, and you have to pay rent, you have kids, you have a car, how do you do it? So we are working with these individuals. We are working in the majority of cases with these families, and we are talking about diabetes and heart disease and prevention, and maybe we need to eat more fruits and vegetables, and maybe you need to cook for your kids, and maybe you need time to exercise, to families that are putting 110 hours per week just to live in a one-bedroom apartment. So these are some of our families renting a piece of carpet for $50 a month to live with their kids. And these are the living conditions of these families. And it's important that we go beyond the maps and beyond the technicalities into who is this person Está María, Teresa, Luis, Juan, Manuel. And we know that it's not easy to find the food that we are recommending. So you are teaching to do the right thing, and the right thing cannot be done. There are issues of transportation, issues of childcare, and the invitation then to say in what way having community workers can help us. And this is, again, we need to think in community workers as part of our team. We have to do a bunch of things. Keep the clinics, get the reimbursement, get the trainings. We have to do so many things that if we really develop our ability to include others, particularly families and community members, this is going to be easier. Because this is not about the short term, this is about the long term. And this is about us keeping the changes, and it's not going to happen if we don't engage communities. And you don't engage communities if we only talk to patients. So if we want to do the political work in a good sense, with capital P, we need to do the community work. And if we want to do all of this with quality, we need to include others. And those others need to be also community members that are impacted by inequities, that understand, that live that. The community that live the data, not just the people that collect the data. So there are barriers, many barriers to a successful partnership. And that includes that there is not a clear role, you name it. The pay, the paradigm, these people don't have high school diplomas, or these people don't have college degrees. So I want to share with you some of the work that we do with promotores. Latino Health Access has 60 employees, 40 of them are promotores. All of them were recruited as participants. They were participants of our programs, and now they are paid with health benefits. And they inform our strategy. There is a community workers council inside Latino Health Access, so the people that are not community workers can learn better this paradigm. So this is Antonio, a former participant, now promotor, teaching the classes on diabetes. He has diabetes, and he works with a beautiful curriculum. We partner with many people. This was a study with Kaiser Permanente in Coachella, with great outcomes and great results. We also partner with Kaiser Permanente in Orange County, and we are their community rotation. Mandatory. They have to come to Latino Health Access and work with our promotores, and we staff their community clinic where they do pro bono work with undocumented, uninsured participants. So I want to share with you a clip about some of this work. So this is a little bit about the physical health. If you imagine this whole ordeal of integrating and then the depression and who helps the lady with the depression and all of that. But I want to share with you a little bit of our work in mental health, in emotional well-being. And I want to share with you that we serve around 9,500 people per year. And we provide probably 18 services per person as an average. Because there are so many things happening in the life of that individual, so many things. So I want to introduce to you Sol, another promotora who was a victim of domestic violence and actually was a promotora helping this lady whose name is Jessica.
Mi nombre es Jessica. En Latino Health Access empecé...
So the promotores... Many of you have community workers in your clinics. If you are going to remember something, remember that it's better to include them as a thinking partner, that they have ideas, that they are experts, and that the work on equity happens inside and outside the clinic. So the community work is extremely important. Promotores do outreach. They find the people. They do the classes. They connect with services. This is in Latino Health Access. We have exercise every day, 2-3 times, Zumba, merengue, you name it. Promotores also change the surroundings, the place. I shared with you a few years ago, how horrible it was in many of these zip codes where we didn't have a single park. It took 11 years for us. I share with you the beginning when we were about to win to build the first park community center in a zip code. And this is our park. It was founded in 2013. Our park community center, Corazones Verdes, Green Hearts. After that, we connected the dots physically in the city. Can we create a wellness corridor so people can walk in places where they couldn't walk before? And we actually did it. We brought the money to create this with business, with the city of Santa Ana. Now we have biking clubs, urban gardens. People are more involved in taking care of the communities. And this caring side of the promotor that actually built trust is combined with the advocacy. Josefina came as a participant. She's one promotora, came with depression. Not only now she helps others, but she's one of our most active members in terms of advocacy. We organize the community, take people to Sacramento to fight for what we think is right, but we also fight for housing. Housing is about health also. And so it's a combination. We have the whole policy strategy with rent control, et cetera. So there are areas and people say, you know, so what is your focus? This is our focus, all of it. Don't ask me to just focus on one thing. It's like saying, what is your focus? Just the kidney, the right eye, the left breast. What is your focus, right? So again, unlearn is key here. Remember who are you, remember how we were trained, and how we need to retrain to move from transaction to relations, to move from you and I being the experts to letting other people bring the expertise, to understand that we belong to a social class, that we have life experiences, that we have privilege, and we might not be the ones, the correct ones to be at the table all the time, or not the only one. So there are many areas in which we need to improve our learning. Collaboration, I'm going to highlight there, because we will need to collaborate with housing, education, and many non-healthcare partners. We also need to learn how to have joy and humility and balance. So rethinking our roles is a critical part of of the task ahead. I want to finish the presentation in the same way I started. The personal is the professional, and the personal is the political. We are working in Venezuela right now, in the middle of one of the most difficult moments of my home country. We created a foundation there. This is the first two classrooms for the kids in Cachamaure, in the east coast of Venezuela. We have 140 kids in a local school, in one of the poorest areas of the country. We are growing food. At this moment, we are growing 2,000 pounds of food per week that we sell or give for free, depending on the conditions of the families. This is my son, who is a Latino and is a lawyer and has a lot of privilege and is part of that foundation. That's my grandkid that is a writer. With this new wave of how to eat your cake when you become 1 year old, which is new for me, right? I'm fighting for Ryder. And I'm also fighting for these girls in Venezuela. And I'm fighting for all the girls and boys in this country. This is personal. Thank you so much.